Welcome to the Art Scene, brought to you each week by UALR Public Radio. I'm Ann Nicholson. Because of the death of Mrs. Betty Bumpers, we decided to bring you a repeat of an interview first heard with Betty Bumpers and Admiral Turner. She had called us asking for airtime, as she and the Admiral had a vital message, which was to warn the world of the dangers from the fall of the Berlin Wall, which so many felt meant peace at last for all to enjoy. My two guests had a much darker message. Hearing of Betty Bumpers' death reminds many of all the good things she did at home in Arkansas when she was First Lady, and worldwide with such as Peace Links. She will be sorely missed. Years ago, on November the 9th, 1989, the world watched in fascination as exuberant crowds helped demolish the Berlin Wall, the, literally, concrete symbol of the Cold War. Much attention is being paid now to what has happened since, and there are many who question the progress made. Here in the West, there still exists great concern over nuclear disarmament, and one consortium under the title Project Abolition is trying to persuade the United States to rethink its nuclear policy. Congress recently failed to ratify the Test Ban Treaty. A speaker's tour featuring prominent figures known for their stand for nuclear abolition began in Little Rock on October the 28th, with Betty Bumpers, the founder of Peace Links, former First Lady of Arkansas and wife of Senator Dale Bumpers, and Admiral Stansfield Turner, director of the CIA in the Carter administration. Both are educators concerned for future generations. Mrs. Bumpers, a former art teacher, and Admiral Turner, naturally as a naval officer, has also taught at Yale University and the United States Military Academy at West Point. In 1995, he was awarded a senior research fellowship at the Norwegian Nobel Peace Institute in Oslo. As a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford after the war, he studied philosophy, politics, and economics, an interesting combination.
I certainly anticipated, with a military career ahead, that the politics would be the most important. It turned out it was the philosophy, because my philosophy tutor at Oxford, where you have one-on-one tutorials, taught me that there are always two sides to a problem, because any position I took, he always took the opposite, regardless of what he believed, and therefore led me into learning how to reason a problem through, including looking at both sides of it.
Did he make you then take an opposite position so that you would argue for what you were against?
Yes.
Whatever. The devil's advocate.
Well, he usually let me take my own position, but then he would take whatever the other side was. And in doing that, made me appreciate that when I took my position, I maybe hadn't thought through all the implications of it, that he had found different implications, and that I wasn't prepared to defend my position as well because I didn't understand the other side of it. When Senator Bumpers argued on the Senate floor, he always had to be very aware, I'm sure, that somebody was going to get up with a good counter-argument. And if he hadn't thought about that in advance, he didn't have his preparation done, right?
Well, in politics, you need more than two viewpoints. You have so many people coming
in. Well, if there are two people in the room, there are three views.
Or more. Then, this Project Abolition, geared to the 10th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, something that really took the world by surprise. What did Peace Links do at that point, Mrs. Bumpers?
We suffered because people thought that peace was here.
Yes.
And we suffered financially and interest-wise. I mean, many people thought, well, you know, it's all over. Now the world is safe and, you know, we really don't have to be that concerned and involved. And so we struggled, still struggle.
Yeah. So how did you regroup then to counter this sort of falling off of support because of this nirvana that everybody got into, thinking that the red menace was now a tame tiger, and hadn't realized quite what, like a dam bursting, the fall of the wall would create?
Well, we never ever gave up on the nuclear issue.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to talk about the uselessness of, they're not military weapons, you know, because we dare never ever use them. And we concentrated on that, but there was very little support for it because people just didn't want to think about it. Mm-hmm. So in order just to stay alive, and because there were many other concerns that I picked up on through, as I said, my children and the young people that I'm around a lot, so we got into violence, the school violence, into other forms of violence, and mm-hmm. always trying to educate that that we need to find new ways of resolving conflict.
Mm-hmm. One of the earliest meetings of Peace Links, when you were taking questions and answers from the crowd, one of the questions was, and it was one that concerned me closely, was how much you were going to be able to reach out to other groups that had the same goals, the same messages, and that this was very much going to be part of your networking in every aspect and try and catch up all around the world if possible. This particular effort that you're all on now in these next few weeks is geared more for a national audience. How are you going to develop it to reach out, because it's needed almost more internationally than nationally?
Well, I think the best thing to do, as we are educating, as mm-hmm. we're convincing the educators in this country that we have to educate young people to think, act globally, you know, because whatever happens here today happens in the rest of the world today. We're trying to engage young people into looking toward global security, not just their own personal mm-hmm. security, but, you know, national security and global security, trying to, I think it will happen because of the changes in communications.
Well, this is what is going to exercise us all, I think. Admiral,
yes.
Getting back to the date in 89 when the wall came down, you had retired long since from the CIA.
Yes.
By that time. What was your position, though? Did you still have the ear of people in power that you could get some kind of immediacy of feedback to find out what the reactions were and how they might be handled?
No, unfortunately, in Washington, when you leave office, you leave power, you leave most sources of information. But
well, with your knowledge of what had gone on before and reading, as you obviously both did very closely, all that came down, how would you have assessed the reaction by the CIA? Because NATO seemed to be caught left-footed.
CIA was caught left-footed, too. And I take some of the blame for that, because it was foreseeable as far back as when I was there, which was through the last part of the 1970s. What we did wrong was not to appreciate that the Soviet Union could not go on indefinitely spending more and not having its economy grow adequately. As early as 78, I briefed the Congress that the Soviet economy was not growing. It was shrinking, not in absolute terms, but in rate of growth. Mm-hmm. And therefore, with its population growth and such forth, it wasn't going to keep up with things. But they were still increasing their military spending. And we did not in the CIA predict that that would lead to a political upheaval. We assumed that this was a country run by people like Stalin, and that they would tell the people to tighten their belts and get on with it. They tried that. It didn't work.
Yeah.
There were no incentives left in the Soviet system, so that people just didn't have any reason to want to work harder. There was nothing they could buy. There was no reason to work and try to earn more.
The efforts then on the part of the Western powers to regroup and reassess what the future now held. I was at a very interesting breakfast in Canada, which was addressed by Margarita Papandreou, the widow of the former premier of Greece, who had started a group, an organization very similar to Peace Links, where the women of Greece, reached out to the women of Turkey to try and resolve some of their differences. And she said in her talk that at the time the wall came down, she and her group went to NATO headquarters and asked various leaders what NATO's plans were now that with the wall down, ostensibly NATO had no longer a need to exist. and nobody seemed to have any answers at all. And I just wondered how much these sort of organizations affected the two of you, particularly you, Betty, with the Peace Links, that somehow over the years of Peace Links, you must have met many of the leaders involved in the European countries and how they reacted to this. Were they all equally euphoric, do you think?
I didn't have the opportunity of being that tuned in or privilege of their thinking. I didn't actually have the opportunity to know what questions to ask. Mm-hmm. And I think the whole world was euphoric. The whole world, sort of like we did, took a deep sigh of relief and celebrated the fall of the wall, the new, what was happening in Russia, and felt like the world was, you know, safer. And so I don't think there was a lot going on in the minds of people, because there was no pressure. I mean, the pressure was let off of them. And that's what we're trying to do now. The pressure has been let off of them. And now we are, what I perceive, are beginning a new arms race.
And this was a little bit Mrs. Papandreou's message was, she explained that the war in Kosovo had devastated her because it was exactly what she had hoped NATO would not find the need to do, that they'd find peaceful means to settle arguments rather than gearing up the military machine to go in and bomb. Patriotism, militarism, and warfare are all masculine approaches to governing, and until there is a better balance, this will continue to be the case. So she obviously feels that women have an enormous role to play in the future in this.
What we need to do is educate what's happening now with the young people of today, with their own children. Educate that there are other ways of resolving conflict. It takes both men and women.
Yes, of course it does.
To be engaged in that.
But it's the how you get into this. You're talking about the abolition of nuclear weapons, of the nuclear arms arsenal, changing nuclear policies. Is the U.S. nuclear policy at odds with its allies? Or are the allies in tune with the U.S. with regard to this?
I think they're generally in tune, but I think that's because we are so dominant in this area that whatever we do and whatever our policy is on nuclear weapons tends to just drive the whole system. There is a little fracturing. Just a few months ago, the Germans floated something about maybe we ought to have a policy that NATO will never be the first to use nuclear weapons. And the Canadians got aboard that, and we tried to squash it, but it's still bubbling around and is in discussion. It's got to come to pass. It's something that we ought to do, and we need to change our thinking. But the major problem today with nuclear weapons rests right here in Little Rock, right here in Washington, D.C. I say Little Rock because most of the American public is not aware of this continuing problem. There are 30,000 nuclear warheads out there this afternoon. 30,000 Hiroshimas.
Known.
Yes.
Because we don't know how many there are in some of these other countries that ostensibly have nuclear capabilities.
No, we have a pretty good handle on who's got what. But the numbers are almost insignificant other than the U.S. and the Russians. I mean, the Russians have...
But it only takes one or two anyway, doesn't it?
Oh, that's certainly true. But we have a great responsibility in this country because we are the leaders of the world, because we have the most vibrant, capable nuclear arsenal, of setting up a pace here, setting a tone for the world, and that is to get our arsenal down to something that could be possibly considered reasonable. But the numbers we have today are beyond imagination.
To defuse them is in itself an undertaking that seems to be out of a man's power to achieve.
It's not. It's not if we use our heads. To actually defuse them by taking them apart and destroying their components is a very difficult long-term problem, because you have this terrible issue of how do you handle the fissionable material, which is radioactive. But you can do what I call strategic escrow. You can take the missiles' warheads off and put them in storage some distance away. And I call it escrow because they're there. And if you have the right circumstances, you can bring them back. Just as when you buy a house, you put some money in escrow, and under certain circumstances, you can get it back. And if we did that, we would not be ridding the world of them, which we want to do in time, but we would be making the world much safer because we wouldn't have them ready for instant use. Now, that's not a problem with us. We're not going to use them instantly. But only if we do this can we get the Russians to do this, and it's a real danger over there. We don't know who's going to be in control of that country tomorrow or next month or next year. And so I say we should lead the Russians into a mutual program of strategic escrow where we each demobilize our weapons by putting them in storage separate from their missiles and thereby reducing the possibility anyone will ever use one of these things impetuously or by accident. So there is a way to defuse the present crisis much more rapidly than we are doing.
And for some reason, it's not getting through to the people who can organize this.
Yes,
the
it's
way
not,
it should be
it's
done.
Not getting through for one very simple reason, and that is that we inherited from the Cold War a feeling that any arms control agreement had to be in writing, had to be negotiated, had to be ratified, and had to have 100% verification. That is, we had to be able to check on every minute detail. I was required to tell the U.S. Senate in 1979 how well we could verify a treaty we were then negotiating with the Soviet Union called SALT II. And I really struggled over giving an honest appraisal of what this would be. And I came up with a feeling, with an opinion, that if the Russians added 100 missiles to their arsenal, that we would know about it. Well, that would be a maximum of 3,000 additional warheads. At that time, the Russians had 40,000 warheads. 3,000 was insignificant. We didn't need the very difficult terms for verifying at that degree of detail at that time. We will someday if we get down to the hundreds of warheads. But we could have moved much more rapidly if we have said, we only need to know within an order of magnitude here what's going on. We don't have to know every precise detail. And that's where we are today, and we need to forget these precise details of verification. George Bush, in 1991, took all of our tactical, smaller nuclear weapons away from positions on our bases overseas and on our ships overseas, and he brought them all back to the United States. Made the world safer because they weren't out there where they might most likely be used. He didn't negotiate this. There was no verification of it. Within 9 days, his counterpart, Mr. Gorbachev, did something very similar in Russia, and it's held until this day with no treaty. So we've got to loosen up and be willing to do that.
Now, with all these trouble spots that are bubbling at various degrees of heat around the world, the Balkans, the Middle East, Indonesia, China, India, Pakistan, Israel, Chechnya, how, when you're going around the country and getting questions, and Betty, particularly when you're working with the young to temper the angers and encourage the voice of reason, How do you do it? What sort of ideas do you put out? The need for communication, the knowledge and understanding of the other side, the other languages, the cultures, the centuries of beliefs and myths that come over that affect you as you grow up. It seems an almost insurmountable task on occasions, doesn't it?
You know, we just finished through the Library of Congress, the Rotary Clubs, the Methodist Church, Episcopal, Catholic, there were about 12 or 15 different organizations, Freedom Force, of entertaining 2,000 young leadership Russians in this country. I came out of that. I visited four different groups where we had them and talked with these people, women. These were all women that we entertained, that Peace Links undertook, 90 of them. even though they are so impoverished and they're struggling so mightily, they are still very optimistic. They have what they wanted most in this world, and that was freedom, to shape their own lives. They're all 45 years of age and under.
What was the youngest?
19. Some of them were interpreters, but they're in businesses of their own. They're some exhibiting some kind of leadership. Their optimism and their understanding, because the world is so small now, and our young people are so much more sophisticated than most people give them credit for.
Now, what intercommunication did these young Russians, these Russian groups have with similar counterparts in this country? With all these conflicts going on, how do you sit down with young people or get young people discussing the opposite approach than going in with guns and rifles and airplanes and bombs?
Well, most of these young people, the young people of today, have a very different concept of that anyway. They're raising their children. Look around. They have a different attitude. I mean, we have to help them move that attitude to not only a personal security for their own personal safety, but into a national safety and then a global safety. As I said earlier, they understand global economics and global communications, but they really don't quite move into their responsibility.
They don't quite understand the effect on villages in India of some of the things that are being developed over here.
They're not connected to that. They have not expanded their thinking that far. We have to help them do that.
So are there any plans afoot to expand things such as the Peace Corps tried to do on a much wider basis so that there's a greater exchange of young people, of these next generations of leaders coming up, that they can visit all these other countries where there is so much turmoil? Or are politics going to come in the way there and you'll be told, no, it's too dangerous, you can't send your people?
Politics only comes into play when the people allow it to come into play. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is what I've been preaching since I got involved in this in the 80s, is that we the people still rule in this country. And the politicians have their antennas out. They know exactly what the people are thinking, and they respond to that. It's just that young people are not engaged, or not only young people, but some of old gray hairs are not engaged in it or not, for those in between. We have to let our politicians know what we want.
They say the best way to do that is to vote, but it doesn't always work that way.
Well, it's not only to vote, but it's to ask questions and to have an attitude of, I guess the best way I could explain that, if we think about smoking, we've known for 35 years that smoking is a very bad thing, but only when it became socially unacceptable did we get the results that we want. I mean, that people have cut down way down on smoking. We have to make violence and wars socially unacceptable. I can't believe that here we are going into another arms race.
But it starts so small with all the guns that people have and all the munitions makers who are there to make a profit and are constantly churning out stuff, and people are there to buy it. If you've got a market, how do you get to the root of some of this, which are the people who make a profit from it?
I think the only way we can do is try to find ways. I don't know the answers to all of these. I just know that we have to be out here trying, because if not, who will? That we have to help young people connect to the idea that it is their responsibility to shape their future. It's as they're embracing trying to shape their youngsters' future with this nonviolent child rearing that we have all over the country, that we have to help them understand that it have to look at violence and how we attain security in a very different way.
I agree with Betty, and she's got so many good points there. There are some good signs on the horizon, though. Look at the war we just fought in Kosovo. What were two of the main characteristics of it? We flew our airplanes so high so that nobody got shot down. What did we do about bombing? We tried as hard as we could not to hit innocent civilian people. We made some mistakes, of course, but there was a great deal of focus. It's healthy that if people are going to go to war, they talk about going to war in as non-lethal a way as they can. That doesn't mean I am endorsing going to war. It only means that there is a seminal trend in the world away from indiscriminate violence. It gets violated all the time in places like Timor. But look at the attention that is given today to indiscriminate violence wherever it happens. The other optimistic point that I'd like to emphasize, we are so much more aware of what's going on in the world today. Americans are very centered on America, of course, and we don't have a good ability to understand other cultures. We need more. But at the same time, I picked up my paper in Washington this morning. There's a story about East Timor. There's a story about Azerbaijan. There's a story about Armenia. There's a story about Pakistan. There are places that most of us didn't know about or care about 20, 30, 40 years ago. People are being made conscious of the fact that there are problems out there, that these are different cultures. Look at all the stories about the new change of government in Indonesia. You can't read those without appreciating it's a different culture. Mm-hmm. Because they're talking about this is an Islamic leader. We don't identify our leaders by their religion generally, and so you have to understand this is an important factor in this country. The religion is key.
And of course, in this country, in America, you've got representatives from every country on earth and every religion.
Yes.
So you should be able to filter through some of these connections the understanding that you're both so desperately seeking.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to emphasize a little bit, talking about the change in society and the change in the nonviolence that we are seeing with rearing families and what Admiral Turner mentioned about war. I mean, it's almost unacceptable. Now, we can go to war. We can have all these wars, but it's almost unacceptable to lose an American life in war anymore. This has been growing since Vietnam.
It's just a pity that the opposing forces don't have that same approach.
We claim loudly, you know, to be the greatest nation on the earth. We need to make sure that we offer a kind of leadership that matches our pride in the nation that we have.
That'll risk a little bit more of your security, of the security that's behind this great nation, the only superpower left. There has to be, along with that, awareness of your stature, an ability to risk it on occasions. Is that a possibility?
It's very significant that while we have not always been alert to heinous things being done by other people, but we're appreciating the fact that people who do terrible things to other people are terrible people and must be punished.
And a country of this nature, this size, and this history that has always met its enemies and gone at them with definition, with determination, with superior forces and armaments, is now going to have to take a definite view with the strength of its ability to pursue the moral ground rather than the lethal one.
That's why I think that our young people today are rearing a new generation. If they will give them the guidance, as you say, if they'll take the risk, and if they'll get involved and understand their responsibility nationally and globally to back up this rearing in nonviolence, that it expand to national and global leadership, and that they must add that factor to the rearing of their children, that we will have a new kind of world in the next 10, 15 years. I think it's a wonderful time. I'm very optimistic because I see this as something that's moving at a very fast rate. If we can just find a way to make this socially unacceptable, then it'll move even faster. I think a window of wonderful opportunity is here.
We've been talking about responsibility of this country to the world, and that ultimately comes down to the individual citizen and the way that individual citizen applies pressure to the people who govern us at the local, state, or national levels. And one of the major problems that we are not addressing as a country today is the excessive numbers of nuclear weapons in our arsenal and in others. And we need to tell the people in Congress that they've got to get much more attention to this. And if your listeners will just open their internets to www.atombombs.org, they'll find a very easy way to send a message to their senators and representative saying, let's please get off the dime and start doing something about this problem.
Admiral Stansfield Turner, former director of the CIA, and Mrs. Betty Bumpers, founder of Peace Links, when they were in Little Rock, October 28th, for Project Abolition, the start of a nationwide tour of speakers against the current U.S. nuclear policy. Others involved in the project include Aaron Gandhi, former Senator Alan Cranston, and actor Martin Sheen. A temporary wall of denial erected in Washington, D.C., representing the thousands of nuclear weapons in United States and Russian arsenals, and dedicated, so to speak, on November the 9th, the 10th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, is intended as a rallying point for the public to visit and sign a petition for nuclear disarmament. For UALR Public Radio, I'm Ann Nicholson.